The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com. It's the story of your life. You're moving down
the page, and you know you're on your way. Good morning, Glory America. It's Hugh Hewitt. I'm going right to the rundown, as there is so much news this morning. Our friend and ally Israel remains under direct missile attack at this hour, with sirens going off throughout the country. Overnight, Israel lost control of many, many areas in the country. Riots occurred, dozens wounded and arrested. Police say among the wounded is a pregnant Arab woman in serious condition after being hit in the head in Lod. Arab mobs torch a hotel in Acre. This is from YNetNews.com. And 374 people were overnight arrested. There have been casualties, including 5-year-old Ido Arigal, who was hit in a bomb shelter yesterday, and an IDF soldier hit by an anti-tank missile. Civilians are also dead in Gaza as the IDF continues ferocious responses. The Ben-Gurion airport has been closed by the missile fire, and many American airlines are canceling future flights. Israel has rejected the truce offer from Hamas. Prime Minister Netanyahu saying, whatever we don't do now, we'll have to do in 6 months or a year, and that the campaign is far from over. And we see the Iron Dome continuing to function at an extraordinary level, but missiles get through when you send them by the hundreds or even thousands. I'll continue to update you throughout the show. I'll be joined by Dr. Michael Oren from Israel later. I'll also be joined by former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, Florida Senator Rick Scott, Jim Talent, former senator from Missouri, Michael Shear of the New York Times, Dr. Francis Collins of the NIH, the director there, will be back as well to update us on the COVID variant in India. The second major story of the day is that scientists are probing the impact of the Indian COVID variant on the vaccine efficacy. They are alarmed. SAGE, which is the group of senior British officials, is meeting as we speak over the rapid spread of Indian variant as number 10 and Boris Johnson downplay reopening fears, but that's on the table. As I was reading the Telegraph to prepare for the show, I also saw this story, which I haven't seen in a long time. As tensions reach boiling point, Northern Ireland's loyalist groups warn of a return to violence. It's been 23 years since the Good Friday Accords, and I've never had to, in the course of this show, report on terrorist attacks in Northern Ireland. Pray that that doesn't come back. During my television career with PBS, it was not infrequently the source in my local radio show in L.A. when I began in 1990, but that would be new and very, very troubling. Domestically, consumer prices jumped 4.2% last month from a year earlier. It's the biggest 12-month increase since the summer of 2008. And the Biden inflation is here. The stock market knows it. Stocks extended their slide on inflation data yesterday. Of course, we also had gas lines. Gasoline buying fever rages with pipeline out of service, is the report from the New York Times yesterday. Anxious travelers circling in Northern Virginia, as well as places as far away as Houston. Don't worry, Colonial's got its pipeline back up and running. There will be plenty of gas. As Colonial says, its operations have resumed following the ransomware attack. However, as the Post notes, Washington Post, economic tremors hit the White House at a crucial moment for the Biden policy agenda. A sharp rise in gas prices and inflation, writes Jeff Stein and Rachel Siegel, as well as Andrew Van Dam, combined with turbulence in the job market, that means no jobs going filled for three-quarters of those open, is creating new economic pressures for President Biden as he tries to secure a legacy-defining, what in the world do we mean legacy-defining? That's nuts. We don't need legacy-defining. We need good economic policy. He wants to throw more fuel on the Barbie. And it's roaring hot right now. They cannot spend another $4.5 trillion. They should not raise taxes. The upside of this is that the housing market surge in the United States, according to the Journal, is making the cheapest home the hottest in long-neglected neighborhoods of places like Youngstown. Fascinating story. Meanwhile, U.S. tariffs put in place in the Trump era have driven a drop in Chinese imports. Levies now cover about $250 billion a year in goods. That is down from $370 billion before the tariffs entered into effect, according to the Journal. Amazon got good news yesterday as it won an appeal over a $300 million European Union tax bill. but Facebook abandoned its plan to run a digital currency from Switzerland. The Facebook-led digital currency project, originally called Libra, now called Diem, is shifting its operation to the U.S. and will partner with a domestic bank to issue a U.S. dollar-backed stablecoin in a big downgrade from its initial global vision, according to the Financial Times. Andrew Yang, who many consider to be the frontrunner in the mayorship, the mayoral election in New York, which will occur this summer, had to walk back what he called, quote, an overly simplistic pro-Israel tweet after progressives, that means the hard left, piled on him for being sympathetic to Israel. So he indulged in some both-sidedism self-criticism, and I had to marvel. This is New York City, and the would-be mayor of New York has to apologize for being with Israel when it's under attack. That's really remarkable. Too bad Andrew Yang folded. I think you know who will run Andrew Yang in the future, given his response to Israel's crisis in the present. Yesterday, a little bit of pop culture note as well. Ellen DeGeneres announced the end of her talk show after next season. She went a long time for any entertainment venue. She has managed to hold it together for, I guess, 18 years, doing the same thing every day for an hour. Of course, I've been doing this for 21 years. Mike Gallagher has been doing it for longer. Mike Gallagher is the longest running syndicated show in America now that Rush is gone. And I'm number two. And I think Sean is number three. And Prager is so far down the list, I don't know. I can't keep up. But the gold is with Gallagher. Although, you know, Mike with his golden pipes, who knows when he's going to retire and go to his palatial mansion on the Gulf Coast somewhere and give up the hard-bitten streets of New York. But he has still got that whole New York thing going. So I don't know about Mike Gallagher, but wonderful host. And I'm going to stay longer than Mike does, just so I can say I'm the longest running talk show in America. Got to get rid of Gallagher somehow, but I'll work on that. Ohio leads the way again. This time I'm not too sure. I really am not too sure about this. I like Mike DeWine a lot. He will win re-election easily, but he announced during a statewide television address yesterday that Ohio Lottery will give five people $1 million. Each from among the vaccinated. The first five of weekly drawings will be held on May 26, according to Mike DeWine, who said that the Ohio Lottery would control them. I know that some may say, DeWine, you're crazy, the governor said. The million-dollar drawing idea of yours is a waste of money. But truly, the real waste at this point in the pandemic, when the vaccine is readily available to anyone who wants it, is a life lost to COVID. That's true. I'm just not sure it's efficacious. I think I'd rather pay people a $100 bounty like Governor Larry Hogan is doing in Maryland for his state employees. Now, I have two mystery illness stories, and people think I'm a Cassandra already. I discussed that earlier in the week in the lengthy interview and podcast with Neil Ferguson about his new book, Doom. People think I'm a Cassandra because I keep my eye open for medical stories, but that's why I was first to the bell on COVID in December and January last year and have never let up. I keep my eye open for mysterious ailments. One of them doesn't look all that mysterious to me. More and more U.S. personnel are becoming very seriously injured in their brains. Spies, diplomats, soldiers, and other U.S. personnel overseas, starting about 5 years ago and now numbering more than 130 people, have come under some sort of an attack, and the cases are concentrated in China and Cuba and number about 60, not including a group of injured CIA officers whose total is not public, according to the New York Times. Someone is trying to injure our people, and the Biden administration is slow to give details because they don't want to alarm unnecessarily people living abroad. But, well, you draw your own conclusion and go read the New York Times. A second mystery illness is in Canada, in New Brunswick. For years, the neurologist at Moncton, New Brunswick, has seen patients with symptoms common to Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, a fatal brain disorder that occurs in 1 in 1 million people each year. The diagnostic testing for the rare neurodegenerative syndrome LEAP keeps coming back negative. More patients with similar symptoms have turned up each year, and Marrero hasn't found another cause. Federal public health officials last year identified the cause as a cluster meriting further investigation. Now Marrero and scientists and doctors from Canada and around the world are playing detective in a medical whodunit, according to the Washington Post, racing to untangle the causes of the brain disorder that has affected 48 people in the Moncton and New Brunswick area. They're calling it the New Brunswick Cluster of Neurological Syndromes of Unknown Cause. Oh, boy.
All that in today's rundown. I also want to tell you, we got great guests today. I will put all of them in the Highly Concentrated Hue podcast later today. If you have to check out of the show at any time, don't forget as well, the interview with Hue Hewitt, my podcast at iTunes, Spotify, and the Salem Podcast Network. It's begun to generate quite a lot of buzz among you folks out there who want to be wise as well as informed. The Hue Hewitt Show, Highly Concentrated Hue podcast, is to make sure you've got the news. And I do it in the first segment of the show, and we slap it up there at the end of the show with the interviews as well. But the interview with Hue Hewitt will make you wise because the people I speak with are wise. So go and subscribe to, comment on the interview with Hue Hewitt, and come right back. Morning Glory America, bonjour, hi Canada. Hue Hewitt, inside the Beltway, just wrapped up a 30-minute conversation with Dr. Michael Oren, former ambassador of Israel to the United States. That will be over at my podcast, The Interview with Hue Hewitt. I'm joined now by Florida Senator Rick Scott. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
Good morning, boy. You can tell we have a new president. Look at all the problems we have around the world.
Well, so I am astonished. I am astonished by the fact that Andrew Yang, who would be mayor of New York, had to walk back his comments in support of Israel. What are your comments on the attack on Israel, Senator Scott, and the Democratic reaction to it?
Well, first off, it's disgusting. I've been in Israel quite a bit, and I was right next to the Gaza Strip, and I was in the bomb shelters. They were showing me. Fortunately, there were no missiles when I was down there, but they showed me how the Iron Dome worked. They've shown me what their their security is for all their citizens. And it's disgusting what's going on. We need to stand up for Israel. We need to stop trying to make friends with Iran. They're not our friends. We need to tell Iran, you want to talk to us? You need to stop being a state sponsor of terrorism. Stop talking to the Palestinians. They're not out there to help create peace. All they do is cause havoc. So stand up for Israel. I mean, quit being Biden, just this weak president that he wants to be everybody's friend, which means he's nobody's friend.
Now, you are the chairman of the National Republican Senatorial Committee in this cycle, which means you're responsible for getting the majority back. I always go over with you Arizona, Georgia, New Hampshire, Nevada. Those are the four Democratic major vulnerabilities. But I am curious whether or not the Biden administration initial failure in policy, jobs number very low, inflation very high, they're trying to throw more fuel on the fire. Is that encouraging people to come to you and explore races?
It's doing two things. One, there's more people that want to run. Two, there's more people who want to help make sure we win. We had, I think, 390,000 donations just the first 4 months of this year to the National Republican Senatorial Committee. And I can tell you, our incumbents are raising money. They're getting out there talking to their citizens, and there's a lot to talk about. You know, open borders, closed schools, men playing in women's sports. Look at the inflation numbers. This is the Biden inflation. Look at the bust in job growth. I mean, it's the Biden attack on business. He doesn't understand that you've got to help businesses prosper if you want to get more jobs. You don't go attack them. You don't go increase the regulations, make it harder to get a permit, raise their taxes. I mean, that's not how you get more jobs in this country. And you're seeing it very quickly. Just like that, you're seeing an unbelievable change in about 100 days. Look at all the problems in this country that Biden has created.
Hashtag Biden inflation is extraordinary to have 4 months into an administration, but he continues to say he wants to spend $4.5 trillion additional dollars. Leader McConnell was at the White House with him yesterday. Have you had a report back from the leader yet as to whether or not he's serious about doing away with the tax increases or curbing his spending in the face of this inflationary pulse?
Of course. No. Biden is in for spending every dime he can get passed. He's in for raising every tax he can raise. Leader McConnell said, look, we are not going back and changing the tax policy from 2017. It worked. We had the best economy in our lifetime right before the COVID hit. Part of it was that we reduced taxes. We let people keep their own. It's their money. It's not government's money. The Democrats act like this is their money. And by the way, when Joe Biden says he's only going to raise the tax when people make it over $400,000, it's a lie. He already did it to the Uber drivers and DoorDash drivers. And by the way, when you look at how much money he wants to spend, there's not enough money of the people that make over $400,000 a year. He's going to tax all of us a lot. I mean, you look at the numbers, it's going to be thousands of dollars more in taxes for all of us to pay for all of Biden's agenda. I mean, the Democrats want to give you everything and then tell you how to lead your life and take all your money. That's their plan.
Well, talk to us about then those four states. Every month I ask you about Arizona, Georgia, New Hampshire, Nevada. Let's start with Arizona. I had a friend who's very, very well connected in Arizona tell me Attorney General Brnovich is looking at the Senate, not governorship. I was surprised by that. Chris Landau is looking at the Senate. There are a lot of people looking at the Senate. What do you know about the Senate seat? And what do you think about Mark Kelly's vulnerabilities? My Arizona friend said to me, the NRSC has got to give us the tools of every vote Mark Kelly takes because he's voting against Arizona and in favor of the hard left Democrats.
Well, Mark Kelly works for Chuck Schumer. That's basically. So if Arizona wants to have, you know, do everything for New York, then they got the right guy. That's what Mark Kelly's doing. We already had ads up against Mark Kelly with regard to the border. We have billboards all across the state of Arizona. This is his crisis. He voted three times against more border security. He has done nothing to secure the border. He goes along with everything that Joe Biden's doing with regard to the border. That's not good for Arizona, and people are mad. Number two is we've got he's very supportive of the Democrat takeover of the election system with H.R. 1 and S.1. And so we've had ads up against that. And so we've got so many people that want to run. We're going to have a great primary. We're going to get somebody really good out of the primary. And Mark Kelly will be a two-year. He'll be gone in November of 22.
Now, Senator Scott, the problem in Arizona, which has plagued Republicans forever, is a late primary. They have the governorship, and Doug Ducey is a friend of mine. They have majorities in both House and Senate. Can they move their primary to the spring so they don't continue a civil war in the GOP up to the primary day?
You know, they could. I had a late primary, and you know what's the other side of it is you get a lot of energy clear up to my primary in 2010 was 9 weeks before the election. So I don't think it's going to be a problem. If they move it, that'd be great. But look, we're going to have a great candidate come out. Arizona is a state that we should win. Mark Kelly doesn't represent Arizona; he represents New York. So I think we're going to have a big win there.
How about Georgia? You lost one candidate, former Congressman Doug Collins, bowed out. I don't know who you've got in the wings. Are you happy with the Georgia recruitment situation?
Oh, there's a lot of people that are talking about running. We'll see. You know, a lot of people are looking at what Herschel Walker going to do. We'll see what Herschel does. But there's a lot of people that want to run there. And Warnock, we already have ads up. In Arizona, our ads are in English and Spanish. In Warnock, we're just doing English ads there against election security. We've got billboards up about he's the one who wanted to get the All-Star game moved out of Georgia. So there's $100 million worth of money that would have come into Georgia. And he said, no, that would come go someplace else. That's not very popular. So Warnock he is so far to the left. That's not where Georgia is. So we've got to do run great campaigns there. We're going to build grassroots. We're going to get a great candidate. We're going to constantly define Warnock. We have people every day at the NRS, National Republican Central Committee. They're defining these Democrats in English and Spanish every day. That's what they do. Because we're going to make sure when people go to the polls in November 22, they know exactly what these Democrats are voting for.
I hope you're calling Governor Chris Sununu every day, Senator Scott, in New Hampshire. Are you talking with him a lot?
I call everybody to try to make sure that I want Chris to run. But look, I hope Chris is going to run. If he doesn't, there's other great people up there. We're going to win. Hassam only won by 1,000 votes 4 years ago. She's not very popular. Again, she just works for Chuck Schumer, whatever he says. She votes that way. So she's a far left liberal. That's not where New Hampshire is. You can see how popular Chris Sununu is. They're not clear. They're not close from a policy standpoint. Hassam and Sununu are not very close. And Sununu is very popular and Hassam is not. So we're going to win there. I hope it's Chris Sununu, but if there's somebody else, we're going to get the great candidate and win there.
And where are the reach races? Nevada, New Mexico. Where are you most optimistic right now of a reach race?
Well, Nevada, we have every chance to beat Cortez Masto. We're already running ads against her. She only won by 2%, 4 years ago. And I think this is going to be a wave election. I think this is going to be an anti-Biden agenda election. So I think we have opportunities there. I think we have opportunities in Washington against Murray. So if you look, the country is not where Chuck Schumer is, and that all these Democrats are voting for. I mean, they're just whatever Chuck Schumer says, that's how they vote. So I think we're going to have great opportunities all around the country.
Now, last question, Senator Scott. Elite media has latched on to the Liz Cheney, Elise Stefanik story, and that's all they're covering. Even though we have a war in Israel and we have inflation and economy, it's like 90% is devoted to a inside the Beltway, inside the House Republican caucus struggle. How much does that impact the NRSC's work to get the Senate back and therefore check the radical nature of, for example, the Biden judicial appointees or future inflationary spending?
You know, the D.C. New York media love to pin GOP against each other, but go out into your state. What are they talking about? They're talking about their families, their jobs, their schools, their law enforcement, inflation. That's what they're talking about. They're not talking about, they generally don't know who. They'll know their senator, they'll know their House member, but they're not going to know who's in leadership in D.C. That's not what they're thinking about. They're thinking about their own family. They got bigger problems than figuring out who's leading the party up in D.C.
Senator Rick Scott, thank you for all of the news about the National Republican Senatorial Committee. Just Google that, National Republican Senatorial Committee, or go to WinRed. Senator Scott, good to talk to you. I will be right back, America. Don't go anywhere. I've got former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo coming up, and Michael Shear of the New York Times. Importantly, Dr. Francis Collin of the NIH will be joining us as well to answer some vaccine questions that rose earlier than this week. And, of course, any late-breaking news from Israel as it occurs, I'll bring it right to you. Don't forget the interview with Hugh Hewitt. If you missed part of the Michael Oren interview from last hour, it will be up at the podcast shortly. Extended conversation with the former ambassador of Israel to the United States. Updated over at the interview with Hugh Hewitt on iTunes, Spotify, and the Salem Podcast Network. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt, joined now by the former Secretary of State of the United States, Mike Pompeo. Good morning, Mr. Secretary. Welcome back.
Hugh, it's great to be back with you. Hope you're well today.
I am, and I hope you are as well. Israel is under attack. What is your assessment of the American response thus far?
Well, the attack is precisely what the Iranian-backed terrorist Hamas would have predicted, a weak response that somehow tried to equivocate responsibility between Hamas and the folks in Gaza and the Israelis, when in fact nothing could be further from the truth. This is the kind of action that one would predict from an America that went back to underwriting the Palestinians through UNRWA, administration that said we're going to ask for restraint on both sides. That is greenlighting these attacks on our ally, friend and ally Israel. It is unsurprising this happened during this administration and didn't happen during our time in service.
In the last 2 days, 25 House Democrats signed a letter condemning housing disputes in Jerusalem. And we had Andrew Yang, who wants to be mayor of New York, walk back his support for Israel, which is unbelievable in a New York City mayoral race. What does that tell you about the Democratic Party and its traditional support for our friend and ally in the Middle East, Israel?
So for my years in Congress, it was largely the case that the support of Israel was a bipartisan effort. And that has changed over these last 6 or 8 years. You have the hardcore folks on the far left, Ilhan Omar, AOC, all attacking Israel in ways that have the deep, deep flavor of anti-Semitism. And then you have more mainstream Democrats, too, who simply refuse to support this important geostrategic partner for the United States. Hugh, it should also come as no surprise the timing. Right now, as we sit here, the United States is engaged in conversations in Vienna to hand the Iranian regime billions of dollars and go back into the flawed nuclear deal. Every Iranian-backed terror group in the region, Hezbollah, the Shia militias in Iraq, now you see with Hamas in the Gaza Strip. We de-designated the Houthis in Yemen. Those terror organizations know that they are about to be flush with cash. And so their efforts to undermine Middle East stability, the Abraham Accords, and Israel's security will continue. This policy of appeasement of Iran is destabilizing in the Middle East. And the fact that Democrats don't understand that, I find shocking.
Less than an hour ago, former Israeli ambassador to the United States Secretary called me, Michael Oren, and we talked about that. I asked him if he was worried about a Hezbollah attack in the north, coincident with the Hamas attack and perhaps coordinated. He said no, because it's in the interest of Iran to hold off, get back in the JCPOA, get billions of dollars and put those into missiles. They want 7 years so they can finish their warhead, finish their intercontinental ballistic missile capacity. Do you agree with Ambassador Oren's analysis?
Well, that sounds logical, but it's also the case, I think, that the Iranians haven't jumped at the chance to take a fantastic deal with the administration because they think they can get an even more fantastic deal with the administration. They've asked for reparations for us having withdrawn from that flawed nuclear deal. Look, I think the Iranians want back in that. In the end, they'll probably do it. They'll run the table. Even today, while the sanctions remain in place, they're not being enforced. So in some sense, this administration has already lifted the effectiveness of the sanctions that we put in place. Yes, I think the Iranians want the time. I think they have the very intention that Ambassador Oren described. They are a regime that has genocidal intentions with respect to Israel. They've made no bones about that. And the United States' reentry into that deal will give them a clear, unambiguous pathway to a nuclear weapon and a nuclear weapons program.
Is it fair to call this a policy of appeasement? And have you talked to Secretary Blinken about this and about the Abraham Accords, which I believe this policy is endangering?
Well, I don't want to talk about private conversations other than we certainly, in our course of the transition, talked about this. But make no mistake, this administration came in with this appeasement plan fully in place. You just need to look at the cast of characters, right? It's the same team back on the field. It is Wendy Sherman. It is O'Malley. It is Jake Sullivan. It is Susan Rice. It is the same cast of characters. Brett McGurk, all the folks who shaped the Middle East policy in the Obama-Biden administration are now shaping this one as well. They're driving us towards a policy where Iran is our central partner in the region, and the Arab states, the Israelis, all of those countries in the Gulf, they know this puts them at risk. We shouldn't forget there are a lot of Americans traveling in places like Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and in Riyadh. Americans are there every day. One of these rockets at some point will kill an American. This has deep implications for the United States security in addition to security in the region.
Also on the field again is John Kerry. 2 weeks ago, it was revealed that the foreign minister of Iran had had conversations with Secretary Kerry when, during your administration, he revealed what appears to be classified material. What did you make of that story? What do you make of Secretary Kerry's extracurricular activities during your administration?
Well, I spoke with Secretary Kerry about this when I was a Secretary of State. He was engaged in conversations on American foreign policy with an adversary of the United States of America. That is intolerable. It is unacceptable. It is outrageous. It is unique. Lots of U.S. diplomats meet with their former foreign counterparts. This is unambiguous. Talk about kids. Talk about fun. If they're allies and friends, you can talk about what the great relationship is between our two countries. But what Secretary Kerry did was fundamentally different than that. We all have now heard the tape that was from Foreign Minister Zarif, Secretary Kerry's buddy and friend. Zarif is a terrorist. Zarif wears a nice suit, speaks excellent English, but make no mistake about it, he is the front man. He is the cover for the Islamic Republic of Iran's regime terror efforts and for Secretary Kerry to have been meeting with him, to tell the Iranians, look, just hang on, you can make it. And when the administration changes, our policy towards you will change. We'll start handing you billions of dollars. Hang in there. Undermined exactly what it was that President Trump and I were intent on achieving.
Now, Shelby Warrick of The Washington Post has a new book out called The Red Line about the Syrian catastrophe, in which John Kerry, Ben Rhodes, the whole cast of character you just made, come off as completely disconnected from the reality of Syria. And President Obama comes off as indifferent to the catastrophe there and perplexed as to what to do. Are we seeing a return to that completely feckless leadership?
It's exactly the same model. We know this model. We've seen it. We saw it in the Carter years. We saw it in the Obama-Biden years. Remember, President Obama goes to Cairo and apologizes to the Middle East for all the harms inflicted on the Middle East from the United States and implicitly by Israel as well. We took a fundamentally different approach. We said, we value you. We want you to be successful. We want a more prosperous and stable Middle East. It looks like President Biden wanted to walk away from all of this. He just didn't want to deal with it. And these folks are going to force us to deal with it. We should deal with it from strength. We should support our friends and allies. They'll do the hard work. They'll do the heavy lifting in the same way that we confronted ISIS, that was beheading people and putting people in cages when we came into office. We found partners and friends in the region to help do the heavy lifting in the region. We delivered better security, more peace, and more prosperity all throughout the Middle East.
Now, Mike Pompeo, you are on the air criticizing the Biden administration and their policies openly with an American journalist. Does that in any way correspond to what Secretary Kerry did? And would you in any way, shape or form approach what Secretary Kerry did during your term as Secretary of State?
I would never and I will never do that. It is completely reasonable for former leaders and government officials to talk about the things that matter to them and why they matter, and to help the American people understand why we did what we did, why it was we took down the caliphate, how we did it, why it was we confronted Iran and the pressure we put on them, taking their foreign exchange reserves down by 96%. That's very reasonable. It's open in the public. People can criticize what I say. I would never meet with the leaders of a foreign country with whom the United States was in open conflict. You'll recall we were in open conflict. They were seizing Israeli ships. They were taking actions against the United States of America that were putting our soldiers at risk. They attacked our they underwrote attacks by Shia militias on our embassy in Baghdad. To have Secretary Kerry commenting on American foreign policy with those leaders is outrageous.
Secretary Pompeo, last question is about the Chinese Communist Party, another strategic front. 10 days ago, the Financial Times reported that Kurt Campbell, the White House Asia czar, according to the Financial Times, had met with a group of their reporters and editors and readers and defended the policy of strategic ambiguity vis-a-vis Taiwan. Some experts, the Times reports, have called for a shift to strategic clarity, which you actually engaged in, to make clear to Beijing that the U.S. would defend Taiwan. But Kurt Campbell, the White House Asia czar, I'm reading from the Financial Times, said such a shift entailed risk. There are some significant downsides to strategic clarity. The best way to maintain peace and stability is to send a really consolidated message that involves diplomacy, defense innovation, and our own capabilities to the Chinese leadership so they don't contemplate some sort of ambitious, dangerous, provocative set of steps in the future. I actually think that statement is provocative. Mr. Secretary, what do you think?
Hugh, weakness begets war. We've known this. We've seen it. We've seen it in action. We saw it in practice with respect to Taiwan. We were pretty clear about the United States' relationship with Taiwan. We allowed our officers to meet with Taiwanese diplomats. We sent senior-level officials to Taiwan to have conversations. We sent our military through the strait. We did all the things that made clear to Beijing and to Xi Jinping in particular there will be real costs imposed on you, and we are going to support the Taiwanese. We sold them F-16s. We did all the things that made clear U.S. policy with respect to Taiwan. That's the kind of message that when it is sent to Xi Jinping, he will understand the confrontation with China isn't necessary, but Xi Jinping gets the call whether that will be the case. When he confronts us, America has to respond, and Taiwan is one of the places that will require American resolve.
One last question, Mr. Secretary. A scoop from the New York Times this morning is headlined, "Mysterious ailments are said to be more widespread among U.S. personnel." It details how the more than 130 personnel in the United States, far more than previously known, according to current and former officials, have come under some sort of attack on their brain. Obviously, you would have been aware of this as Secretary of State and probably Director of the CIA. Is this Time story helpful or is it not helpful to protecting our people abroad?
I haven't seen the story. It's the New York Times, so I'll take it all with a grain of salt. We did see these issues when we were serving. We saw people that had been impacted by something where they had real injuries. We did our best on three fronts. The first one was to make sure they had the world-class medical care. Second was to make sure they and their families were in a place where they could make good decisions about how to protect and defend themselves and to get the health care they needed. And then we spent a lot of time trying to figure out how it happened, from whom it was occurring, if it was from an actor, and to determine how to confront those actors. We spent a lot of time working on it. It was a confounding problem. I wish this administration well in figuring it out and pushing back against whoever it is that's hurting Americans.
Mr. Secretary, great to talk to you again. Thank you for joining us this morning in defense of Israel. And do you expect this war to go on long? We got about 45 seconds, or will Israel shut it down quickly, in your opinion?
Hugh, I don't think Hamas and the Iranians are going to shut it down quickly. I expect we'll see a number more days of these kinds of activities. I hope the Israelis understand that America will, in the end, have their back. Israel has every right to defend itself, and I'm confident that they'll do what they need to do to secure their people and their borders.
Secretary Michael Pompeo, thank you for joining me. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Have a great day, sir.
Brought to you by ReliefFactor.com. $19.95 gets you started on ReliefFactor.com. I talk about it three times in my daily show. At the bottom of the first hour when I take it, and then in hours two and three when I remind you to take it, depending on when your commute begins, because ReliefFactor.com works. It's the only supplement I've taken in 30 years of broadcasting. I've declined every other opportunity to take a supplement, and I'll tell you why. Because ReliefFactor.com actually works. I carry in curcumin and resveratrol omega. Temporary relief for the relief of minor aches and pains. Temporary support for the relief of minor aches and pains. And you can't do better than that three-week starter pack, $19.95. Yes, on The attack on Israel is now posted at the Interview with Hugh Hewitt on iTunes, Spotify, or the Salem Podcast Network. I'm joined by former Senator Jim Talent. Good morning, Senator. How are you, and what do you make of what's going on in Israel?
Well, I mean, I thought your interview with Michael Lauren, and I haven't listened to the one today. The one yesterday was fantastic. This is Hamas overplaying their hand, by the way, I think, trying to exploit what is basically a landlord-tenant dispute in Jerusalem. In the context, and this is what's really important, I thought Ambassador Oren had to be a little bit restrained in discussing the Biden administration policy, but the administration has been reaching out to Iran and putting distance between itself and the United States. And whenever you do that, you create instability in the Middle East. I mean, we don't have an ambassador to Israel yet. You know, he didn't call Netanyahu up for weeks after his inauguration. He took the Houthis off the terrorist list. He restored the aid to the Palestinians. We didn't get anything from this. And, of course, trying to revive the JCPOA sends the signal that the United States is going to try and rebuild some kind of security construct with Iran. And when you do that, you embolden these radical elements. And I think Hamas is trying to make itself relevant after the Abraham Accords, trying to recall attention to itself. So it's a bunch of things converging, and it's very dangerous.
I had Mike Lauren on again this morning, and he said the Iranians will not allow Hezbollah to attack because they're going to get billions of dollars from a JCPOA that is renewed and strengthened. Secretary Pompeo was just on with me, and he said not only renewed and strengthened, it's going to be a bonanza. They're rejecting the return to the deal offer because they want to run the table, to quote Secretary Pompeo. Do you fear that's going to happen?
Well, I'm very concerned about it, in part because, and in large part, because that relief will be used as it was used 6 years ago to replenish their proxies, including Hamas, including Hezbollah. And one of the scenarios that's a nightmare scenario is an attack on Israel from both Gaza and the northern border at the same time. One of the constraints on that is that Hamas and Hezbollah only have limited supplies. If they think they can get resupplied easily from Iran, they're more likely to attack. Now, I have a lot of confidence in the IDF. I mean, I think this whole episode shows how much Israel's learned from the war 7 years ago, because they're targeting better. They have better tunnel technology. I mean, Ambassador Oren talked about all of this. But, you know, what we don't want is for Israel to have to escalate in order to control the situation, because that's just they're going to suffer reputational damage. And, of course, it has the risk of derailing the Abraham Accord. So I think that's the game here. And, yeah, I'm concerned about it. Who wouldn't be?
Yeah, Ambassador Oren said earlier, and again, it's up at the podcast, this morning conversation, that if Hezbollah attacked, it would be a make my day moment from Dirty Harry, for a reference that young people may not get, but that Israel would bring the hammer down everywhere if they did that. Do you agree with that assessment?
Well, I think they'll have to. I mean, they can't, you know, they're being attacked through the air, and this time by 100 rockets at a time from Hamas. Well, I mean, Hezbollah is 10 times the number of rockets that Hamas has got. You can't just allow these terrorist groups to be shooting rockets at your civilians. You have
to. They're bigger and faster too. They're more deadly rockets, right? And they're missiles that are killers.
So Iron Dome gets a lot of them, and this is true for any missile defense system. I mean, it's a very good system. It was developed, as you know, jointly with the United States. But when you get mass attacks, some of them are going to get through, and the Israeli government is not going to be able to put up with it. Now, I don't know. I have to listen to your interview this morning. I don't know if you got more into Israel's domestic situation.
He did.
That hasn't helped anything.
No, he thinks that's actually a bigger problem than Hamas. I got to ask you one quick question, though. You mentioned the landlord-tenant dispute at the beginning of the conversation, Senator. Mm-hmm. Yesterday, 25 House Democrats signed a letter to Tony Blinken asking him to condemn the East Jerusalem evictions. Whatever you think of that legal dispute, they've been attacked. There are a half dozen Israelis dead, including a five-year-old boy, an IDF soldier, thousands of missiles launched, and 25 Democrats want Blinken to condemn evictions?
It's a landlord-tenant dispute. Now, it has its roots. It goes back to 1948. We can argue about it. You know, and I know, that the Israeli judicial system is one of the most independent in the world.
I mean, they don't do what the government, even if the government was telling them to do something here. And the Israeli Supreme Court continuously does things the government doesn't like. I mean, this is being adjudicated the same way it would be here, probably, frankly, better than it would be here. And we're waiting for the results. It's a property rights dispute. Now, yeah, I get it. Unfortunately, Jerusalem Day came at the same time, and the suspension of worship in the mosque because of COVID. I mean, there's a bunch of sort of exogenous things happening here that have made this worse that really nobody's responsible for. But again, and then the response of the administration to treat this as, or to say things, it sounded like there was a kind of equivalency between Hamas and Israel. Exactly the wrong thing to do. They keep doing the same thing over and over again, and I'm talking about Biden and expecting a different result in the Middle East. It's not going to happen.
The only different result came under President Trump and Secretary Pompeo, the Abraham Accord. Jim Talent, former senator from Missouri, thank you. Follow him at Jim Talent on Twitter. Follow me to Hour 3 of today's Hugh Hewitt Show. Good morning, glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway as war rages in Israel. I've talked this morning at length with Ambassador Michael Oren, former Israeli ambassador to the United States. That is now up at the podcast, the interview with Hugh Hewitt. He called me yesterday. He called today. That update is packaged and over at the podcast. Former Secretary of State Michael Pompeo joined me, Florida Senator Rick Scott, former Senator Jim Talent. Now I'm joined by Michael Scheer of the New York Times, chief White House correspondent for that august organization. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Hugh.
You wrote yesterday about the domestic economic situation. It does seem like an avalanche of bad news hit Team Biden at exactly the wrong time to move forward their, quote, legacy plan.
It does seem like there's a kind of, you know, series of bad news that is kind of getting in the way of what the Biden administration is trying to do. The gas prices, the situation in Israel, I think the only thing that you can say that was sort of positive about the meeting that took place between the president and the leadership in Congress was that it didn't sort of break down into a screaming match like some of them did during the Trump administration.
There was a moment after that meeting between the leadership and the president where the president talked about meeting with the Republicans. Let's play the cut where he forgets who the House GOP is.
I'm encouraged not just because of a solid meeting with the Republican leader in the House and with Mitch or Senator McConnell, who I've known a long, long time and worked with.
Yeah, now, Michael, I forget people's names every day. Right. Like that guy in the booth next to me. I don't know what his name is. He's been producing the show for 20 years. I'll remember in a bit. Right. But, you know, it's tough on Biden, isn't it, to have moments like that?
Yeah, it is. I mean, look, I as somebody who stumbled on air myself a bunch, like I'm somewhat sympathetic to anybody. We all know that, right? I do think actually, though, there's a little bit of a deeper thing that underscores, which is that to the extent that Biden talks all the time about his relationships with people, he does not have any kind of a relationship that we know of with McCarthy. That was one of the things that was sort of underscored at the meeting yesterday was that McCarthy, much more even than Senator McConnell, came into that meeting determined to shift the conversation, right? To talk about high gas prices, to talk about inflation, to talk about Israel, to talk about the colonial pipeline and gas prices. And so you could see this the reality there, which is that progress got made, and that's partly because those two men don't have any sort of relationship.
Leader McConnell, in fact, came out and said this in terms of changing the subject. He also wanted to lay down some markers. Cut number 14.
We're not interested in reopening the 2017 tax bill. We both made that clear to the president. That's our red line. We believe that in February of 2020, we had the best economy we've had in 50 years. We believe that was a major reason for it. And so, from my perspective, this discussion about the way forward on infrastructure will not include revisiting the 2017 tax bill.
So that's a red line. Now, we know what happens when red lines get crossed. The position collapses. So it's going to be reconciliation or nothing for the tax hike.
Well, definitely for the tax hike. I mean, I think that the direction that we appear to be headed in, it's unclear whether they're going to be able to get there, is, I think, splitting this bill into two, where there is some kind of smaller, spending package for traditional infrastructure that Republicans can get behind, that they want to get behind because they want to be able to go back to their constituents and say, yes, we, you know, supported building your road, your bridge, improving your airport, what have you. But that part of the package may be somewhat bipartisan, may be something that can, be gotten behind and not be done with tax increases. And then, of course, the Republicans would essentially dare Biden to do another package for the rest of the stuff that they want that would be done with reconciliation and with only Democratic votes. I mean, I think that's the most likely scenario.
You know, Michael, that seems to me to be giving away your leverage if you're the Republicans. If you're willing to do, as Shelley Moore Capito, Senator Capito, is leading the Republican negotiation on the infrastructure, if you're willing to do $600 billion, that's, we're getting inured to the idea of trillions. $600 billion is a lot of money. I mean, it's an enormous spend. And if they're willing to do that, I think they need but we will not raise taxes along with that, especially for businesses getting hit by inflationary pressures and a lack of ready employees, especially as retail reopens in the United States. Why would the Republicans give up that position in exchange for, okay, you won't tax us for three more months? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, and that's I think it's the Republicans in a way, if the Democrats are managed to get Joe Manchin and the rest of their Democrats united behind some kind of a tax increase, the Republicans are in a tough spot, right? Because in theory, the Democrats can then push a tax increase through with or without Republican support. And then the question for the Republicans become, okay, well, if that's going to if that can happen with Democrats without our consent, then is there something we want to get behind so that we're not just looking like we're saying no to to everything that our constituents want? And your point is well taken, and it could be that they decide in the end, we're just going to stand opposed to all of this. But I think that is the challenge for them. That means the Democrats have to be united, and that's not 100% clear either. So I mean, I think a lot is up in the air still.
One of the things they have talked about is the death tax 2.0, which is like the Death Star in the second edition of Star Wars when they brought back the Death Star. The death tax is one of the worst absolute taxes, and the stepped up basis abolition with an exemption it will crush family businesses. I just don't think the Republicans have any incentive, because if they do that, they're never going to vote for that, Michael Scheer. Never. It's a party destroying. I know the Manhattan Beltway media loves to obsess on Trump and Liz Cheney and Elise Stefanik, but the place that the Republican Party will break is if anyone supports death tax 2.0.
Right, but I think I think McConnell made clear that that they will not support those, that kind of tax increase or any other kind of tax increase. I mean, the question is, can Shelley Moore Capito, can others craft some kind of a modest bill that doesn't rely on tax increases, that relies on either, kind of reorienting some of the spending from the stimulus program that's already been passed that relies on increased user fees or those kinds of things that don't amount to tax increases like the death tax, which, as you say, is extraordinarily unpopular with the Republican base. I think that the question of whether they can figure out some way to do a pared down infrastructure package without raising taxes, I think that's still up in the air.
All right, Michael Scheer, last question. Today in Great Britain, the SAGE Committee, which is their scientific advisory group, is meeting with the prime minister and other senior officials at number 10 to discuss the Indian variant of COVID. They are alarmed, and a lot of scientists are alarmed by the Indian variant. Maybe it will penetrate our vaccine. Maybe it is a vaccine-avoiding variant. Do you think the White House is prepping for that? Have you talked to Ron Klain or anybody about the White House preparedness for a vaccine that effectively undoes all the work of the vaccination campaign?
So in the conversations that I've had with Jeff Zients, who's their vaccine or their virus sort of coordinator and czar and others, they are extraordinarily concerned about variants. But the balance that they're trying to strike is to both be prepared if a variant from India or elsewhere does arrive here and seems to be avoiding the vaccines. They're trying to be prepared for that while at the same time balancing the sort of panic and desire that the country clearly has to reopen. And I think, you know, I imagine, don't know this for sure, but I imagine the scientists are, you know, in the government are racing against the clock to see what they can do if the Indian variant really is as bad as the people expect.
Michael Shear of the New York Times, always a pleasure to talk to you. Follow him at Shear M on Twitter. Follow me to the next segment of today's Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway, joined again by Dr. Francis Collins, director of the National Institute for Health. If you don't know Dr. Collins, one of the leading scientists in the United States, led the Genome Project to its amazing completion. Also a great evangelical spokesperson. He's written about that. Dr. Collins, welcome back. It's good to see you again. I appreciate you returning so soon.
Nice to be back with you, Hugh. And we got big news now about being able to immunize kids 12 to 15 with a vaccine that's safe and effective. So let's get on with that. This is a really good moment.
Let's go right there. Pfizer and I believe Moderna are now cleared. Is Moderna cleared as well, Dr. Collins?
No, Moderna is still putting their data together to submit to the FDA. So the clearance that got announced yesterday by CDC was just for Pfizer. That's that two-dose thing. But anybody who's interested in getting their kids immunized who are 12 to 15, you can do that now. And by the way, the easiest way to find out if there's a site near you is to go to vaccines.gov and find out what's the place closest to you that has the Pfizer vaccine and get your kids signed up so that they can once again start, you know, hanging out with their friends and doing sports and maybe going back to school in the fall without having to worry so much about this doggone virus.
If you had a 12-year-old grandchild, Dr. Collins, and maybe you do, would you urge them to get vaccinated?
I have a 14-year-old granddaughter, and I have most definitely urged her to get vaccinated, and she has signed up.
All right. That is terrific. But that kind of testimonial, by the way, is the best kind of testimonial. Let me do two other headline stories before I go to the objections. I did a whole show on objections to the vaccine. I want to throw them at you. But first, let me ask you about gain of function research. It's become a contentious issue. I'm looking at NIH symposium you held on gain of function. Could you explain for the Steelers fans out there what gain of function research is?
Absolutely. And there has been a lot of noise about this and a lot of the information is not accurate. So let me try. Basically, this is the kind of research where you're studying a particular pathogen in a very tightly controlled environment to try to understand what about that virus or that bacterium might we most want to be worried about that nature might develop into an even more dangerous organism. We do this under extremely tight circumstances. The NIH has only approved that kind of research in a couple of instances for influenza. We have never approved that for coronaviruses. But now there's a buzz that maybe that Wuhan Institute of Virology was conducting that kind of research. We don't know that. There's no evidence for that. And let me say categorically, NIH would not have supported any such research on coronaviruses because there are risks there that you might actually end up producing a virus that has a higher danger attached to it than what nature has already come up with. Again, the reason to do it is to try to have a little forecast of what we might need to watch out for that nature could develop. But that should only be done under very carefully controlled circumstances. We have in the United States a rigorous system for overseeing any kind of gain of function research like that. And it's only really been utilized twice for influenza.
Now, I just heard you say categorically the United States did not fund research of gain-of-function sort into the COVID virus in Wuhan, would they have funded? Can you say the same thing about gain-of-function research, period, of any sort in Wuhan?
We, of course, do not have internal insight as to what was going on at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. NIH strongly supports the position that we need a more thorough investigation of what exactly were the origins of this virus. The original WHO study was not considered to have been as thorough or as objective as it needs to be. NIH, working with the State Department, the Agricultural Department, and WHO, is insisting upon a more careful and more objective analysis of everything that happened in Wuhan back in December of 2019.
But can you rule out, Dr. Collins, the United States having funded any sort of gain-of-function research in Wuhan?
We absolutely did not fund gain-of-function research in Wuhan.
All right. That's great. Let me ask you about the Indian variant. As we speak, the SAGE Committee in Great Britain is at number 10 meeting with the Prime Minister about the Indian variant. We talked about it last week. Are you more worried or less worried this week?
Well, I'm heartbroken by seeing the way in which this is devastating India in terms of its risks to the rest of the world, and particularly the risks that maybe the vaccines wouldn't work against it. I'm somewhat encouraged by the more recent laboratory data that makes it look as if the Pfizer, the Moderna, and the J&J vaccine do have pretty good activity against this so-called B1617, which is the Indian variant. We need to get a little bit more of that data in hand, but right now it's looking encouraging.
You're stressing the Steelers fans out. They don't go over two digits, doctor. Let me go to some of the objections that were called into me. Greg in Ventura, California said, quote, I'm 72. I haven't been sick a day in my life. Why would I get the vaccine? How do you respond to that, Dr. Collins?
Well, a lot of people who've never been sick a day in their life are going to get sick. In fact, it's almost universally the case. So why would you not want to take advantage of something that's proven safe and effective, and for which you at age 72 are at a particularly high risk if you happen to get infected, that you could end up in the ICU or even die? So yeah, your past history is not a predictor of how you will do. There are lots of people who were totally healthy until a few months ago and got COVID and ended up in very bad shape or even died. 580,000 people have died in the U.S. Let nobody imagine that could not be them.
Doctor, I said to him, even if you are got a remarkable immune system, you could still be a transmitter of the disease and you would be less likely to transmit the disease if you had the vaccine. Did I give him correct information?
You are so right, Hugh. So you took my argument to the next level. Thank you for that, because that's a point. This is not just about each of us taking care of ourselves, although that's a lot of it. It's also taking care of our family, our neighbors, our friends. Let's each of us try not to be the super spreader that is going to cause danger to others.
Yeah, in the new book, Doom, by Neil Ferguson, it's a fascinating look, Dr. Collins. I recommend it to you. It's about disasters in human history and the pandemic. He said that it's continuing to be the case that super spreaders are 20% of the cases and they create 80% of the secondary infections. Do you agree that 20-80 rule?
I don't know the data that backs that up. I think that's somewhere in the right vicinity. I wouldn't want to say it's exactly 20-80, but certainly super spreaders have disproportionately contributed to the spread, but nobody knows if they're one of those or not. Another reason, coming back to the point you just made, get everybody vaccinated.
Tim in Phoenix asked, I've already had COVID. I don't need to get this.
You know, that is an argument that I would have probably said was right a year ago, but there's data here to say, actually, that the vaccine provides you with better long-term immunity than natural infection. That seems surprising. You would think the natural infection would be the best possible way to generate antibodies. Maybe it's because natural infection basically affects your respiratory tree, whereas the vaccine gets to your whole system and gets your immune system really revved up. So we strongly recommend people who've had COVID-19 should still get vaccinated. That'll give you the best protection going forward.
A third one. This is very interesting to me. The J&J research used aborted fetuses, to which I responded, I'm Catholic, and that's not an objection the church raises. You're an evangelical doctor. What do you say to that?
Well, that is an issue that I think pro-life people have been concerned about. Let's be clear what we're talking about. A fetal cell line that was derived in the 1970s from a legal pregnancy termination in Scandinavia. This cell line has been growing in laboratories for the last 40 years. It is a very useful way for vaccines like the J&J vaccine to be produced. And so that's how they grow this particular vaccine in those cells. The Catholic Church has looked at this, and they say that it's entirely ethical for Catholics to take advantage of this vaccine because it's life-saving, even though it has this long 40 or 50-year connection to something that they would not have approved of. I understand the circumstances there. Let me just say the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines are not grown in fetal cell lines. And let me also say that the rumors that are out there that the actual vaccine has recently derived fetal tissue in it are absolutely false.
Let me add to another buzz conspiracy theory. I'm not sure if it is. It's an objection that came up repeatedly. It's an experimental vaccine. The FDA has not approved these vaccines. They've only given it authorization for experimental use. I did my best to explain that's a distinction without a difference right now. But Dr. Collins, you'd be better at that than I am.
Well, we have experimental use authorization, EUA, and people have heard those three letters a lot, because of the need to move quickly when there's a pandemic and people are dying. But before FDA has its full information about 2 years of follow-up, which is normally what might be required for a full endorsement. By the way, Pfizer has now applied for a permanent endorsement of their vaccine. FDA is looking at that data. I don't think this is a distinction that should discourage people at all from taking advantage of the vaccine. The EUA is still very rigorous, and all the data is out there about safety and efficacy. So people should feel quite reassured that this system works. We have in the United States the gold standard for looking at safety and efficacy, and that standard has been met for the vaccines that receive the emergency use authorization.
Dr. Collins, Amy gave me a two-pronged objection. One, I'm 40 years old and still of childbearing age. I don't want to compromise my ability to have a baby. And secondly, if I got pregnant, I'm afraid it would influence the baby adversely. To what you respond to that double objection?
Those are very reasonable concerns, and I think a lot of women have had those. At the present time, there is absolutely no evidence that the vaccines cause any risk of infertility. And I think we would know that by now. Similarly, I don't think the disease itself has affected fertility. We would know that. It's been around long enough. In terms of the risks to pregnancy, we also have looked pretty carefully at that. There's a paper published about a week ago looking at outcomes of pregnancy for women who did get the vaccine, more than 35,000 of them. No evidence that it had any negative effect at all. And let me also say, pregnant women who get sick with COVID-19 are at higher risk of severe illness, and that's something to pay attention to. The vaccine is probably particularly a good idea to avoid that kind of outcome. Just the same, women with those concerns should talk to their OBGYN doc, get the information from their own provider. But the evidence would say, the person who's writing to you, Amy, it's okay. The likelihood that the vaccine is going to hurt you seems to be extremely remote, and the likelihood it could really help you is quite compelling.
I don't know if you've watched coverage by Tucker, who's a friend of mine, Tucker Carlson, but he continually brings up those incidents of bad response, as news people can and should do. Have you seen any negative response to the vaccine that gives you cause for concern about pulling it back in any way?
Well, there was the concern about the J&J vaccine and this rare clotting problem, which CDC just yesterday announced they've done another survey. There are 28 cases out of about 9 million people who got the J&J vaccine. And that is a significant clotting issue, although it is treatable. When you go through the math, your likelihood of being benefited by this single shot vaccine is still vastly greater than being hurt. But that is the reason they did a pause on that vaccine before studying it carefully and then allowing it to be injected again. I have a 19-year-old grandson and a 21-year-old granddaughter who both got the J&J vaccine, and I'm really glad they did.
My last two questions, doctor, very, very effective questions. One was, look, we've had SARS, MERS, and Ebola within the last 10 years. It took 5 years to get vaccines for Ebola. Why can we possibly trust the rush in this case? And by the way, don't we have another pandemic coming?
Well, there's two questions there. So Why trust the rush? Again, we were in the midst of a threat to the whole world. You would not have wanted the scientists to take their time, I don't think. It's interesting that the fact that we were able to do this in 11 months is unprecedented, but it's also causing people some concern about whether corners were cut. Look, I was right in the middle of all of this during the development of the vaccines, and I can tell you no corners as far as safety or effectiveness were cut at all. What we did was to get rid of some of the downtime that normally takes years to go from the idea of a vaccine to having it approved. All of those bureaucratic steps, all of those points where you have to make some plans that maybe you should have made ahead, those were all stripped away. And this was done thanks to Operation Warp Speed in a very rapid fashion. But people, look at the data, and I think you would be convinced probably there's never been a vaccine that was studied more rigorously with more people, 30,000 or more, before deciding whether it worked. And is this the last pandemic? No, it's probably not the last pandemic. And we are learning lessons every day to prepare for what we might need to face going downstream. And that's something you will want us to do. We must not slip back into complacency after this one. We have to think about ways to get ready for whatever's out there coming the next time.
In your head, Dr. Collins, do you credit Donald Trump with Operation Warp Speed, along with your obviously scientific community and the people who funded it and HHS for guiding it?
It was an amazing team effort. I particularly want to shout out to Secretary Alex Azar, who's really the person who came up with the idea to have this all of government effort, including doing at-risk manufacturing so that we wouldn't end up with a successful vaccine and no doses to give to anybody. So, yes, it was a remarkable effort, and it's one of the reasons we got there in 11 months and we've saved a lot of lives.
That was artfully crafted, Doctor. Does President Trump come in for some credit there?
Well, he was, after all, the president of the United States, and he approved the effort. And I stood with him in the Rose Garden in May of last year when this was announced. And Moncef Slaoui was brought on board, a remarkable leader, in order to make this effective. And it really has been an amazing experience.
My very last question this morning, Dr. Collins, was from Sally in Atlanta. I'm taking ivermectin. My doctor recommended it. It's 80% effective. Why would I take the greater risk of getting sick when my doctor has told me to take ivermectin?
Well, ivermectin is interesting but unproven. It is a drug that was developed to treat a parasitic disease. There is a general sense that maybe it helps if you're positive for SARS-CoV-2, that you take this and you won't end up in the hospital. We are about to run a trial to really figure out if that's true. A lot of the data so far is pretty conflicting. Remember hydroxychloroquine, where everybody was really sure it worked, and ultimately, when you did the rigorous tests, turned out it didn't? We need to know whether ivermectin is actually one of the greatest things around, or whether it's another one of these false hopes. And right now, we don't know the answer. So I'm not sure why her doctor is telling her this is proven. At the present time, if you go and look at the expert data, it's still up in the air.
Dr. Francis Collins, please keep coming back. I'll keep getting the questions queued up for you, and I appreciate your time this morning. And good news on your grandchild getting the vaccine. I will recommend the same when I ever get one that's 14 or 12 or older. 12 or older. Thank you, doctor.
All right. Thanks, Hugh. Good to talk to you.
Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, joined now by Alfredo Ortiz. He leads the Job Creators Network. He has a new piece up at realclearpolitics.com this morning. Alfredo, good morning to you. Thank you for joining me. Let everyone know you're a sponsor of the program. We love hearing from you.
Hey, good morning, Hugh. Thank you for having me, as always.
Tell us about the Real Clear Politics piece. What argument are you making about Biden administration policy?
Well, you look, I mean, this is a continued effort, we believe, by the Biden administration and Democrats to really wage war on small businesses. In this particular case, it's with lack of credit access, which, you know, for small business owners is really the lifeblood of these small businesses. And so back in the fall, October of last year, the Trump administration finalized what was called the True Lender Rule, which basically allowed the fintech and corporate commercial banks basically to work together to be able to allow further access for our small business owners. And basically what the Democrats are looking at right now through this Congressional Review Act is to actually repeal that rule, like they're trying to do with everything that's Trump-related. But in this particular case, this repeal is really going to hurt you access for credit for small business owners who are actually dependent on fintech in addition to all the other traditional lending programs that are out there.
Now, the CRA is a powerful tool, Alfredo. As you know, if it's invoked, not only is the rule repealed, you can't go back to that subject ever again. Are members of the Senate on the Democratic side, I believe it's filibuster proof. I believe you can pass it with 51-50 votes.
That's right.
Are members of the Democratic Party aware of the adverse effect on small businesses of this CRA proposal?
You know, Hugh, I don't think they really care. I don't think they've stopped for one second and asked themselves that question for any single thing that they've proposed from day one, you know, with the cancellation of the Keystone Pipeline that killed about 12,000 jobs to the mandate that they're pushing forth on the minimum wage of $15 per hour. I just don't think they really care. They say they care, but when you look at their actions, Hugh, actions speak much louder than words.
Well, the CRA repeal would bar every regulatory relief effort having to do with lending. In my view, that's my understanding of CRA. It's a very, it's a flamethrower of a law that when you repeal a rule that is within the 1 year passage, you can't go back there again. I think this has got to be a focus to educate Democrats about, because they will end up really hurting small businesses.
Yeah, and remember, under Dodd-Frank, I mean, community banks were decimated over the last decade under that Dodd-Frank. In fact, nearly half since the year 2000 of community banks actually closed since then. So, you know, the fintech has really come to the rescue, and it's been a really needed program, especially in the COVID environment as well. But, you know, this is really very worrisome for our small businesses, and we really need to make some hay about this as well, Hugh.
Alfredo, people can go to Join JCN, Join Job Creators Network, joinjcn.com to become a part of this effort. The news on inflation was very dreary yesterday, Alfredo. What is the impact of inflation specifically on small businesses?
Well, I mean, in addition to the massive, colossal miss on the jobs report, where you have about 266,000 jobs added versus the million expected, the inflation piece is very worrisome. 4.2%. We actually called it. We did an article a few months back where we were calling this kind of Jimmy Carter 2.0. And I'm telling you, we're going to start seeing this. And it doesn't, you know, doesn't really surprise me, though, when you think of all the different policies and what the Biden administration is pushing forth. People are already anticipating the higher tax environment. You know, the greater demand obviously is just pushing prices up. But in addition, you know, the higher regulatory environment, I mean, everybody's basically positioning themselves for higher costs. And guess what? Those higher costs just get passed down to the consumer. And that's where we're exactly seeing lumber, for example, 11% up. I mean, we're seeing eggs, bread, milk, you know, tomatoes. I mean, you name it. Everything is going up high single digits, if not now into the double digit area. And remember that 4.2%, Hugh, doesn't really include energy prices.
Alfredo, is it true, as we upset about foreign affairs, if the United States catches a cold, the world has a fever? Is it true that if big business has some sorts of agitation, you can count on small business convulsing? It's really bad.
It's really bad. And the problem is that, you know, big business, frankly, is almost in line now with Democrats on this one. You know, we're very concerned. We mentioned the $15 minimum wage. I mean, you had Amazon literally up in D.C. lobbying for the $15 minimum wage when they were well beyond that. But, you know, it's kind of convenient for them to do that because in 2020, Hugh, they had a profit of over $21 billion. So it's great that they can keep pushing for higher minimum wages and higher wages at Amazon. But what's right for Amazon isn't right for Main Street America. And so,
you know, Alfredo, on that point, I have a new Washington Post column out this morning on Josh Hawley's book, The Tyranny of Big Tech. One of his arguments is that the anti-competitive practices of the big tech sector is really crushing small businesses. Do you agree with that generally?
100%, Hugh. It really, really is. And, you know, Amazon likes to put out those ads that, you know, we support our small businesses because that's what makes Amazon great, et cetera. But, you know, the dirty little secret is Amazon takes what a successful small business is doing on their Amazon site, and then they replicate it and it comes Amazon Choice. And they take it internally. And it kills the little small business that actually started it.
The state attorney generals will not like that. Alfredo Ortiz of the Job Creator Network, great piece in realclearpolitics.com. You need to join JCN if you're a small business. Whether you have one employee or 50, go to joinjcn.com. Great sponsor of this program. I'll be back tomorrow, America, with updates from Israel and around the world and everything going on in the United States as well on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.
Portions of the Hugh Hewitt Show are brought to you in part by Job Creators Network.